cliffcentral.com.
Very warm welcome to you, and thank you so much for having us on. I'm Sean Woodley, and welcome to the 2017 Human Rights Day special on racism, proudly presented to you by ANSA, the Anti-Racism Network South Africa, and cliffcentral.com. Whether you're streaming live on Cliff Central or have downloaded the podcast, we appreciate you for listening this morning. So again, good morning. And with us, we have Dr. Karen Abrams, and then we also have Professor Melissa Stain. And what's very interesting about both of them, Doc and the Prof, they're part of Wits University, and they serve Wits. So it's great to have you. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
It's great having you. Melissa?
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show
too. It's always great talking to you, Melissa.
A pleasure.
As the national convener of ANSA, I'm honored and excited to lead the discussion for the next hour or the next 45 minutes on the current campaign, Take on Racism, and it's important, and the importance and the impact this week and ANSA has in terms of the country. So we're talking about today is today is Human Rights Day, and this is what the program is about. So to you, Karen, the first question to you is, what does this, as a South African that comes out of apartheid, what does this day mean for you?
Well, I think I come out of the tail end of apartheid, and so I didn't really experience the kind of heat of it as others might have. But I think that this day is particularly interesting for the generation that has seen both, because we exactly are on the cusp of it's almost a new beginning. People say that, you know, South Africa has been at it for 22 years, but in a longer history, 22 years is just the beginning. And so it's quite an exciting time. It's also quite, I think, sobering to know that these racist incidents, you know, they keep on happening. They may have always happened, but now they, through social media and other medium, they are more visible. And I think it's really apt time right now that we can engage with this generation and seek change. And so that's quite exciting.
Ah, thanks, Karen. Melissa, the same question to you. I mean, just your own view. You have a history of our country. Today we celebrate, Human Rights Day. What does this mean for you?
Well, you know, Sean, I think as a white South African who was born sort of in the deep apartheid years and lived through 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, giving my age away here. you know, it's a really important and gratifying experience to be able to be part of correcting the past. It's an incredible gift that history has given white South Africans. I think that it's not very often that when a really deep social injustice has been committed in your name, that you get an opportunity to participate in righting those wrongs. And this is an opportunity that white South Africans have. I don't believe that many South Africans, I don't believe that in a broad-based way that white South Africans have taken it on that way. But I think that Human Rights Day gives us the opportunity to again ask ourselves, how are we participating in the post-apartheid South Africa, and how are we participating to create the human rights out of the human wrongs?
Oh, lovely. And so today we would look at the end of Anti-Racism Week. So I'd just like to just give you a background of ANSA. ANSA is the Anti-Racism Network South Africa, and this network has been formed by the Nelson Mandela Foundation and the Ambedkar Tata Foundation. And the feeling of both foundations was that in order to tackle this racism, it's virtually impossible for single individuals or just individuals and a few foundations. And so the idea was, how do we begin to start a network? And so their investment into this network, so we have between 80 and 100 civil society organizations around the country that makes up part of UNSA. We have a footprint of UNSA within in six provinces, and hopefully this year we will launch it in the other provinces. And so one of the key projects or ideas for UNSA was to come up with an idea that will be able to give South Africans a platform to express themselves around the issue of how do you take on racism. And that idea was Anti-Racism Week. So we have Anti-Racism Week. And there's four things that Anti-Racism Week talk into. The first one is, how do we take on this racism? And the first idea is that we need to start to learn about racism. The second one is that we need to talk about it. And the third one is we need to speak out against racism. And the last one, if necessary, how do we act against this, and what are the channels that one could do that? So this is Anti-Racism Week, and it ends today. So just to go back to Dr. Karen, Doc, just based on your experiences around a young South African, what has your contribution has been to in terms of taking on racism?
I don't think it's been, you know, huge. There are many other people in South Africa that are doing, you know, much more. And I think I see my contribution as guiding the process. I'm a researcher by training, as you know, and me together, I together with Melissa and others have sat on the steering committee of UNSA for the past 3 years, and also in its inception, talking through how what a network should be. And I think, apart from, you know, the everyday, my everyday challenges to racism within my own family, within my university, is this bigger project. How can we build this project? And I think for me, that's been something that I consider somewhat of a calling or a vocation. How to best think through this, and how to think through it between what government does, between what civil society does, and ordinary people, and how we can bring those things together with the help of universities and other researchers to really make this project work and really fight back against racism. So I think that's been important for me.
And thank you so much, Karen, for being part of this process. Melissa, you've been part of UNSA, and
yes.
But in terms of your personal, as you speak about white people within South Africa, what contribution have you been making in terms of taking on racism?
Well, Sean, I think I've got the dubious sort of pedigree of having been the person who first started writing about critical whiteness in South Africa and about white identity. And, you know, sort of critiquing the underpinnings of whiteness, which is not quite the same as racism. But we aren't actually going to sort of clear the decks of racism if we don't also at the same time understand how whiteness operates, because there are these systemic ignorances and blind spots within whiteness that need to be addressed, and people need to raise consciousness, their own consciousness around that. So there's a lot of work on that area, but of course I also run the diversity studies, the WIT Center for Diversity Studies, and all our work is engaged with challenging systems of privilege and oppression, of the creation of otherness and systems of marginalization. So I suppose I can just say that this is like rather like what Karen said. I mean, I think for some of us it is vocation. And I see answer as a very important expression of that vocation, moving forward in a way that links together civil society organizations, and how do we make this part of the yeast of our society? That I think is the great ambition that we have.
Right, Dr. Karen, you've been doing some writing recently, I believe, and some research. Can you just share that? I think you launch a paper within the next week. Can you just shed some light on that for us?
So for the past, I think it's a year in the publication process, but there's a publication coming out within the next few weeks, and it's a publication jointly of the Kathrada Foundation and the Gauteng City Region Observatory, both organizations. Organizations that I used to work with and alongside. The publication's called Pathways to Anti-Racism. And it's an edited contribution by different authors. And it also includes a photo essay, some poetry, some of the workshop material that Melissa's unit conducted year before last, speaking to SRC members, talking about what will an anti-racist society look like. And it's together, I think, the publication gives us a real sense of a visionary set of beliefs about the kinds of things that South Africans from across the board, whether we are involved in governance, that means in the state, trying to look at how do we address racism, how do we tackle the scourge without creating, again, classes of people, without witch-hunting racists, but also to realize that in a racist society, we carry within us some of those beliefs. And really, the publication's focus on practice, and that links to the conference that ANSA hosted last year, the practice of anti-racism. So we may debate about what it is and what it does, but what we have to be clear on is what we can do to take on racism. So you'll see lots of the slogans is be aware, be brave, be courageous. And it's all of these things about how we actually undermine, challenge, and confront racism. So the publication deals with the practices that we can bring on board, either state-led practices or organizational culture practices or everyday modes of just being with fellow South Africans that throw up these kind of racial norms and our racist behavior.
Great. So, Karen, in the next couple of weeks, how are we going to get hold of this paper?
It will be available on the ANSA website, as well as the GCRO, the Gauteng City Region Observatory website. And so it will be an online, totally free publication. It is linked to a YouTube video, so that will be on the social media, and then we'll have a way to download that.
Yeah, Melissa, I've been listening to you before this, as you speak about whiteness. I think many South Africans would like to know what does white privilege mean. Some probably do know. But what is white privilege, and what message do you have for white people that are in denial that this thing doesn't exist?
Okay, all right. Sean, white privilege, has a family resemblance to all these other positions of dominance in society, so like male privilege or heterosexual privilege. So what we find in society is that although we have been taught through sort of the discourses of liberal humanism that the country or the nation consists of individual people in relation to the state, and in many ways human rights are framed within that understanding. However, if you really look at society, you can see that different groups are positioned relative to each other. So depending on how we are understood to fit into society as either men or women or people who've been raised in particular ways, for example, those differences have been made to mean something. over a very long period of time, so that some people are systematically advantaged in the way in which that difference is understood, and some people are equally but opposite are disadvantaged for the way in which they differ along this particular axis of difference, if you like. So the construction of race, which is at least a 500-year-old, maybe even more, construction, systematically has placed people who are understood to be white, people who are understood to be descendants of European stock, to use the sort of like eugenicist type notion, have been systematically given the advantages of the way in which race is understood. So race being understood ideologically as being a superior way of being, and actually being just the normal and proper way of being human. And this construction has meant that, you know, all the goodies in society systematically are siphoned away from people who are understood to be black towards people who are understood to be white. So this is materially, economically, you know, in terms of benefits of having your culture regarded as superior, but also psychologically in terms of feeling that you are a superior person. And white privilege is the normalization of that arrangement. It's made to seem just the ordinary, everyday, proper way in which society should be organized, that it's completely natural that white people should be in positions of greater material advantage, be getting the best of everything that society has to offer, and that black people should be there in relationships that are more inclined to be service or support to white people. And that's the normalization of whiteness. So when you're socialized within that space of whiteness, that you just take that for granted. It just seems like the right way for the world to be. And of course, part of that is a complete ignorance and misunderstanding of how these relationships really are constituted, and how they really do come about, and how they are based upon a social injustice. So you find that within the space of whiteness, it's a subjectivity that's shaped within relations of domination. And people whose understandings of the world are shaped within domination tend to be very unaware of a lot of the really important things about how society actually operates, and don't understand themselves as being the recipients of an unfair advantage. So, you know, I think that sort of gives some sense of, yeah, of sure. what we're looking at, you know.
No, great.
So if I can just also say, yeah. so there's what you could call an implicit racism that's built into whiteness, which is, you know, that the very assumptions that have shaped the subjectivity, shaped your sense of self, are racist, even if you aren't actively, you know, sort of embracing or employing racist thinking. It's actually what shaped your world. It's what holds your world in place. So that's a lot of work that needs to be done to actually come to understand those things if you are a person who is you know, socialized as white.
Right. Karen, there's also, as we do know, that privilege was, there was a percentage of privilege in terms of all race groups.
Yep.
And so there's also a denial by certain race groups within blackness. They deny they were privileged. You want to share a little about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I think so much of the blame for racism has been cast at the feet of white individuals and not whiteness, as Melissa explained, this constructed idea of whiteness and domination. And I think it's particularly this personalization of individuals that makes it a little tricky. So on the one hand, let me just, you know, start off with the idea of criminalizing racism, and, you know, we might have different debates about that. But the difficulty with that is that it personalizes it. So it suggests that racism is not a systemic 300-500-year-old construct that we have grown up with and live within. It suggests that it's just a deformity, a pathology within certain individuals. And so that, I think, that individualization of racism is a really tricky thing. And at the same time, the individualization of privilege. So as we know, in apartheid, privileges were given and withheld from certain race groups for particular political reasons. And that may have been to coerce certain race groups to carry out or to kind of imbibe the racist practices of the day. In fact, some schools of thought even say that the whole idea of classifying different race groups is a form of privilege that, or a form of race making that sets us apart from each other. And so those kind of privileges exist with education, with the way our cities are planned, the way group areas were planned, just the way people grew up. And I think when you talk about why people deny privilege, I think on the one hand, it's a need to identify with the oppression that all black populations faced in South Africa and across the world. But also it's a way, I think, of suggesting that distancing oneself from racism. And when Melissa talked about those kinds of subjectivities that people live with every day, I think that's a really tricky one, because at the same time, someone who classified Indian or colored could talk about experiences of racism while at the same time exhibiting racism themselves. And so I think that's a really interesting thing that we have to deal with. So when we think about anti-racism within our particular context, those are those layers of racism that becomes part of our everyday ways of being. And so that's why we need to undo these forms of racism at every step.
Thank you, Karen. So let's just get back to Anti-Racism Week. During this campaign, lots of young people, and when we engaged, the big question is, what is racism? I mean, that's a question that comes up all the time. There's different views. Is xenophobia racism? Is the issue of gender? So people will begin to say, please, can you please define what this is? So, Melissa, how would you define? Because we're going to take on this racism. What are we taking on? I mean, that's the question that's coming up all the time.
So I think let's make life easy for ourselves and acknowledge that it's a very multifaceted issue.
Yeah.
You know, and I think part of the trouble we get into is when we try to say, you know, this is racism, not that, and then somebody else has got, you know, a different part of the picture, and we're fighting, you know, this internal struggle about who's actually understanding racism correctly. Yeah. And in many ways, I think that incapacitates us. And we also need to be asking ourselves, for people who are wanting to be able to perpetuate, you know, discrimination or exclusion and don't want it named racism, what is at stake for them there? Why are we pursuing that particular agenda? So I think we need to be always asking ourselves, who's getting to define this for what purposes, you know, and with what effects? So that's just the preamble, okay. But I think the important thing, and both Karen and I have talked about this now already just today, that we have to understand that the deep logic of modernity, the deep logic that has shaped the whole global world through the period of modernity, was that of white supremacy. So this is something that has been built into the whole way in which modernity has been organized. And so if we're wanting to work to eradicate racism as this deep DNA of our society, we have to think in terms of the systemic ways in which it's been structurally built into society, but also the ways in which, what we were talking about earlier, the ways in which it's shaped our very understandings of ourselves, what we've internalized in terms of internalized dominance, internalized oppression, and things like that. So this is, indicates to us that this means that it is going to be multifaceted, because it's going to be, have been given a kind of an expression, whether it's economic, whether it's social, whether it's cultural, whether it's individual. You know, it's going to, racism is going to be found in all of those things. All right. The one thing that I do think, though, is that we do have to understand that it was a system of white supremacy. It was an ideology of white superiority. So we can't, I think, take that out of the understanding of racism. However it gets refracted in other configurations and in other social contexts and within other, you know, groupings of people, that is at base what has started all of this. So, yeah, I think it obviously does have individual expression, and I do think that we need to hold individuals accountable for egregious expressions of racism, but that in itself, if we're only looking at those individual expressions, we're not getting to the heart of the matter. We can't actually deal with the issue, because those are in ways always symptoms, and we need to look at how it gets diffused through the whole of society. I don't know if that makes sense.
That's fine. Karen, yeah. You want to add to that?
Not too much. I mean, broad agreement with what Melissa said. And I think, you know, if racism is, you know, defined, has to be defined in so, at so many different levels, a kind of structural level, a kind of way of being in the world, as well as interpersonal understandings of how people treat other people, then anti-racism has to also function at those levels. Mm. It has to be about these broad beliefs in society, the broad culture within which we operate, as well as undoing structural racism through institutions and how groups of people are categorized and groups of people are treated by institutions of the state or other organizations. But it must also tackle interpersonal forms of racism. And total agreement, we can't only focus on one of those things. Mm-hmm. So to suggest that anti-racism is only about criminalizing acts of racism on social media is a very narrow way of looking at the breadth of our response to this ingrained societal scourge of racism. So what we need to do is both balance those, dismantling those structural and interpersonal forms of racism, and seeking out ways that racially oppressed people are less racially oppressed, whether it's by the state, whether it's by political parties, whether it's within our institutions, in our universities, in our churches, in our homes, in our domestic spaces, and so forth.
Oh, great. Just talking about Anti-Racism Week, and so I'm just throwing out some of the questions that I've experienced and people have been asking me, and what's coming up clear is the hate crimes bill. Now, I hear you talk about it, we're going to have to look at a multifaceted approach, and this is one approach. Will this make a difference? If we're looking at, yes, we will look at a multifaceted approach. This is one approach. Mm-hmm. What difference would this make?
You're asking me? Mm. in broad terms, I'm actually in favor of it, mm-hmm. because I think that we do need certain baselines for how we behave together as a society. I mean, we all know that there's certain things that we just don't do in public. where there are certain things that we just don't do when we're wanting to have sort of social, the spaces in which society operates and is given expression. And I think that this is one of them, is that if you're writing something that is going into the public domain, I think that it is important that you learn to edit it. And I don't mean it just physically edit it. I mean in terms of what you're actually saying, that you think about it because it has an impact on other people, because a society is built up of relationships. And this sense that in some ways, you know, you can speak out into the world and it's not actually going to land somewhere, I think is a very dangerous way of performing your selfhood. So I think that people do learn. I think people are put up much more resistance when something is anticipated, and I think once it's there, they learn to adjust. And I think that we do need to say this is not something that we allow in our society. We don't want it. People must actually think about the effects of what they're saying.
Good, Karen. So this is one approach and one facet, as we would say. What would be some of the other facets? What would be some of the other approaches that we need to be looking at in terms of, because what the hate crimes bill will do will control behaviors within our country, and that's what it will do. But in order to bring about this behavioral change, any ideas of what we could do and where should we start?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think the bigger question to ask is how do governments govern for social change? And I mean, that's the kind of thing that's occupied my thinking a lot. It's a course that I teach, and one of the ways is, of course, the idea of the hate crimes bill, and it's absolutely necessary because we don't have one. Mm. In fact, we are at the very final stages of approving the National Action Plan Against Racism. And the first action of the action plan, the first of many actions, I should add, is the hate crimes bill, and bringing that to the fore. And I think a lot has been done by the Department of Justice in bringing that to the fore and getting comments. And I think all of the comments are in. I think the danger, and the report that will come out soon, this pathway to anti-racism, there is a chapter written by Dr. Keila Irwin from the Durban University of Technology, that she looked at national action plans and what that has meant for the practice, the ongoing practice from particular countries. And she noticed that countries that, as a first step, started criminalizing racism, sometimes that became the only response. And that every year there would be a revision of the criminalization of racism or hate crimes, and that governing social change or talking to anti-racism only became about criminalizing it. And that's certainly not enough. It's a great start. It's a necessary start, because people have to be held to account, as Melissa was saying. People can't just think that, you know, it's okay to think particular thoughts about people, to use particular words, to act in particular ways. It's not okay. And it's unequivocally not okay. And that hate crimes bill draws a line under it. And I think that's what's really necessary about it. But we must not forget that it's the first of many actions against racism that needs to follow. And we can't only criminalize on the one hand without building institutions, ways of teaching young people in schools through education about how to treat each other. It's not just about learning national anthems and the kind of myths and legends of our South African story. It's really, Melissa will tell you more about this because her unit at WITS has been focused on this. The basics of how we regain our humanity. If if the state's focus is not also on that, then I think we are doing a disservice to society just by talking about criminalization. But that said, in societies where things have been criminalized, in generations to come, they became part of the norms of society. At this stage, you know, it might drive racism underground. It might, you know, give it a more private face where people are free to express themselves in private and have a public persona or a persona in the companies that they work for that's more PC, let's say. And so I think it's the start, but it's not the end.
Melissa?
You know, I can't agree more. And I think part of the problem that has sort of led us to this moment where we are experiencing a crisis anew is that South Africans have had this compliance mindset that even, like, for example, within organizations, policies like employment equity, like affirmative action have been implemented in the spirit of compliance. So it's like, yeah, how can we just do the absolute minimum in order not to get into trouble with the law? You know, and what we actually have found in our own research is that, ironically, focusing just on the numbers means that you don't even get the numbers right because people don't stay. If they're working in an environment that is still in many ways characterized by racist assumptions, they don't feel welcome, they feel excluded, they feel in hostility, they feel that they're not properly recognized, they feel they don't belong, and all of those things, they feel that their voice doesn't really matter. And all of those things add up to a situation where people do leave. So the numbers, ironically, don't actually get sorted out either. So, and that's just talking about the workplace, but it applies across the board in society. We absolutely have to do the deep work that has to do with, as Karen said, regaining our humanity. And this is something that we all have to do on all sides of the question of racism. How do we get to firstly understand how racism has structured society and people's understandings of themselves, and how do we then work to change that around? It's not an easy process. It can be quite destabilizing. But I think that it's really important. And Sean, if I could just say that I think one of the processes that is involved in that is the whole question of our history. I mean, it is really, really important that, speaking specifically about white South Africans, that white South Africans get to understand our history, because the way that the history has been perpetuated in the past has been part of the construction of ignorance around the true relationships that have built this country, the founding relationships of this country. And as long as white South Africans are certain that those knowledges are the right way to understand our country and how we've come to be where we are going to constantly get into trouble, like we've just seen with Helen Ziller. I mean, there has to be a real engagement with what the truth is about colonization, and what the relationships have been, and the impact that this has had on people's livelihoods and their sense of the humanity. And unless we do that as white South Africans, we will always be unable to actually relate to our fellow South Africans. It is an unbelievably big barrier to a proper sense of relationship.
Great. One of the key things during this week that has been one of the highlights of Anti-Racism Week was the wristband campaign with the Department of Justice within schools. And because we got to ask the question, where do we start? I draw the analogy just working with young people and working with kids using the flu. That young kids at school, we got to start to build the immune system. Mm-hmm. And that's critical. So we have kids, some kids might have a running nose, but they just don't have flu. where adults have double pneumonia, I put it that way, because it's part of our DNA. We grew up with that. My question is, how do we build the immune system of young people? Because that's critical. For me, when we build a strong immune system, the virus, when they get to their uncle's house at the braai, their parents, that they their immune system has to be strong because this virus is coming in. I mean, we need an antibiotic, to deal with our stuff, and thus the anti-racism week and a whole lot of stuff, because we need to cure. How do we prevent? And that's the thing. So my question to Karen and to Melissa, how do we build the immune system of young people so when this virus comes, they could be strong in terms of taking on racism and all forms of discrimination?
Well, I'm a very strong advocate for what we call critical diversity literacy. So it deals with not only racism, although, you know, very, very firmly and centrally with racism, but also, you know, the constructions of patriarchy that position women as inferior, heteronormativity, the way in which age gets constructed. So we do try to bring together all these intersectional readings of privilege and oppression. But the point is that we do have to introduce this, I think, in school, and we can do it in an age-appropriate way. We can start with little children, the very basics. And unfortunately, what we do find is that we know that children don't construct difference as a way of discrimination. That's something they learn from us, and particularly in the family as the primary site of socialization. And the unfortunate thing is that we find that they're fine when they're little. It's when they get sort of like into high school and you see all this stuff kicking in, and that is because of the influence of family. So because this is, it's so pervasive, and it is, like you say, we catch it like we catch measles and mumps. The point is that it's not good enough for families and teaches the school system to say, you know, we aren't actually encouraging this stuff, we don't use racist language, whatever. The point is that you actually have to be constructing an anti-racist family and an anti-racist school. So you've got to be actively working against these dominant assumptions that are going to be influencing the child and that the child is going to catch. Unless we are, as you're saying, and I like your analogy, building up the immune system.
Karen?
I like the analogy too. And with a newborn, he's particularly. This idea of antibodies, and I'm going to start off with that idea that Melissa ended with. Unless we actively insert in that into society, we do need, continue on your medical analogy there, active antibodies to it. It's not just a case where we can protect ourselves in a kind of plastic bubble. It's not allergies that we catch.
Yes.
It becomes part of our body, our way of being, and it affects our behavior. And unless we insert it into our behaviors, our practices, our ways of thinking, the opposite, the antidote to it, then we're never going to rid ourselves of it. All we'll do is sanitize against it. All we'll do is say, you know, this is not right. But it won't create people who act in a particularly different way, a different culture, a different way of thinking. So I think, to use your analogy, we can't just sanitize against racism. We can't wash our hands clean of it. It needs to be inculcated into our practice, into our ways of being, become part of our DNA, to use the metaphor that Melissa used earlier. If racism was part of our DNA and how history's DNA, anti-racism must equally become part of that DNA.
Wow, I like that.
And it doesn't happen by just letting things sort of roll over.
For sure.
Yeah.
So let's take the four things of anti-racism week. The first one is to learn about it. So let's, what are the handles? People listening to us, how do we learn about it? Where do we learn about it? And so we want to go through those four things. And then Karen, have you got your paper with you that you could just probably read a piece for us probably at the end? So if you can just start preparing yourself for that. But let's just take on the four things, the issue of learn about it, talk about it, speak out against it, and act against it. What does that mean? And you can probably take all four at the same time. Okay. And we'll go to Karen, and then we'll end with Karen.
Okay. Well, you know, I think the hashtag take on racism is really important, because what it indicates to us is that this is not a passive process. This is something that we have to be committed to, and we have to understand it as part of our own lifelong process of learning, of becoming fully human. So, there is so much material out there, if we are serious about it, that we can learn. And it just isn't good enough to sort of suggest that somehow, you know, the material isn't available for learning. We can, but we have to want to. So it has to be something that we commit to. And the same goes around the speaking out and the acting. We're working on a project that deals with the whole notion of the bystander. You know, because it's so much easier to just keep quiet, which is to let things roll over. But how do we recognize those moments at which, you know, an oppressive structure is being reinforced in the micro moment, you know, because it's all these structures of oppression obviously need everybody in a way to be on board all the time, to be sort of reinforcing it. How do we recognize when that's happening? Through a comment that someone's making, or the way a particular person's perhaps being ignored in a particular situation or whatever. And how do we become upstanders, as they use in the jargon, so that it's like that we interrupt it, that we actually say, hey, wait a moment, that's not on, you know? Because actually it takes very little, very often, to interrupt something. People back down quite quickly when they know that they're doing something unkind or unjust. So I think we can all, in our everyday lives, learn to be acting, to be interrupting, and to be working towards an anti-racist society.
Karen?
I really appreciate what Melissa says. It's really good. I think one of the commitments, I think, to how we tackle this, and it's a carryover, I believe, from that historical idea of non-racialism, where solidarity was at the center of it. People fought against the racist state, the racist apartheid state, not only for themselves. They didn't fight racism for themselves and what they could benefit from it, or how it could protect them individually. They fought against the racist state and racism for other people. And so you'll see in the marches, the women's marches and so forth, hunger strikes, jail sentences, all of those historical things that, you know, are so important for all South Africans to realize. The idea of solidarity for society's good was a very big, it's a very important idea. And I think within anti-racism, we need to recapture that idea of solidarity. So it's not only for me and mine. It's not only for me and my family. It's not only because it affects my job or my paycheck or my sense of self and well-being. But as Melissa says, when we can care about the other and stand up, so not be bystanders, but realize that this is our society. Mm. And fight against racism on behalf of those who maybe don't have the courage to do so, or maybe are so oppressed and feeling so low that they don't even have the self-belief to do so. And I think that is a responsibility, that is a societal responsibility. So that's just as one comment to something that I thought about after hearing Melissa. And maybe just to quote from this the anti-racism report.
It's called the Pathways to Anti-Racism, right?
It's called Pathways to Anti-Racism.
Right. Yep.
And it's a 2017 forthcoming publication. Commitments to undoing the effects of racism may take many forms.
Mm.
As is evident in the papers in this publication, government, civil society, and individuals can drive anti-racism strategies and practice. For some practitioners of anti-racism, the content of anti-racism work may well be social dialogue, those kinds of programs. Pursuing forms of economic distribution or creating integrated human settlements. Rather than prescribing the content of our anti-racist practice or programs, what we need to do is encourage scholars and activists and ordinary people to consider how a broad social project of anti-racism and its social outcomes may unfold in South Africa. What we need to do is add to a discourse of renewal and collective transformation, including both structural, palliative elements to racism and visionary, everyday politics that move society towards solidarity. And I think that's the spirit of that publication, Sean.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. And I think, thanks, Karen. Melissa, just give you one more minute just to wrap up this discussion. I think it's we need much more time.
Yes. But just to express a really strong appreciation for what Karen has said and what has been written in this book, Pathways, and I also just want to add that you know the notion of how we build society upon solidarity towards social justice, I think, is right at the heart of what we need to be doing and how we need to understand the work that we're doing in the anti-racism network generally. And I want to also just add to that this is not, for example, for me to do anti-racism work is not about charity towards black people. The solidarity has to do with my own self-respect. I actually have to reclaim my humanity. So my own skin is actually in this process. For all of us, this is not about patronizing or sympathy. It's about how do we build a society in which my own self-respect, my own humanity is also affirmed. Because unless our society is affirming everybody's human dignity and everybody's humanity, it detracts from mine. And there's only one way for us to move forward, and that is for all of us to be gaining dignity and self-respect and human value.
Thank you so much, Melissa and Karen. And thanks for Cliff Central for giving us this opportunity. But as we end Anti-Racism Week today, let's still be reminded that it's not about only about the week, but how do we take anti-racism work beyond this week and carry on the themes of be aware, be frank, be challenged, be conscious, be brave, and today is about how do we become, because that's what it's about. It's becoming, you know. One of the holy books says, unless we become like little children. And that's how do we become anti-racists? How do we become activists, actively involved in eradicating racism? And if you look at the pathways to anti-racism, what Karen was saying, we need a collective approach. It's civil society, it's faith-based organizations. Everyone, and no race can be left out in this country when we're dealing with Anti-Racism Week. It's impossible to leave anybody out. So we got to look at how do we be inclusive in terms of dealing with this. And for those that are listening, become part of ANSA. You could go onto our webpage, ansa.org, and see how you could get involved in that. Again, thank you so much, Karen and Melissa, and to Cliff Central. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. CliffCentral.com.